Morning again, everyone. Well, I took so long in the announcements because this sermon that I have for you is not particularly that long. It's one that I've thought about. It's one that I would like to develop further, but so this will be 1.0 on this. But my sermon is entitled Joshua and the Conquest of the Mind. So, if you title takers down there, write this down. Joshua and the Conquest of the Mind. I'd like you to turn to Joshua chapter 1 with me this morning. There's a lot of detail in Joshua that we can read about that has significance to our spiritual life. It's often one we don't think about. Let's go through some of those things today. I'd like you to just read here from Joshua chapter 1, and let's just read through verse 9. After the death of Moses and the servant of the Lord, the Lord said to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise and go over this Jordan, you and all this people, into the land that I am giving to them, to the people of Israel. And every place that the sole of your feet will tread upon, I have given to you, just as I promised to Moses. From the wilderness and from this Lebanon as far as the great river, the Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites to the great sea toward the going down of the sun shall be your territory. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. And just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you. Be strong and courageous, for you shall cause this people to inherit the land that I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous. Be careful to do according to all the law that Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may have good success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be frightened and do not be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. You know, in all the books of the Bible, and possibly in all history, there's never been a greater commander than God's servant Joshua. Military historians look at Joshua and they consider his greatness. Even some of the great commanders of the ages have studied the battles in Joshua and considered how those things went about to learn from him. Joshua was responsible for taking the land of Canaan as an inheritance for the Israelites, a land that God said would be a holy land for his holy people. It would be a special place that he had prepared just for them. And Joshua took that task and responsibility, and he held it in very high regard. And he was a man after God's heart. And it was no doubt, I think, a very daunting task that was set before him. To be able to go into a land that you haven't been into before, that's been spied out, that giants existed in the land, and you had multiple city-states all over the place with Canaanites and all the other ites that were all throughout the land, into the mountains and into the valleys, that they had to wipe out all of these people in their land. But God told him three times, we read. Three times he told him to be strong and to be courageous. That even though there were people in the land, there were many that he had to battle, that God would be with him throughout his journey there. And Joshua's story stands for us in the Old Testament, not as simply a historical account of the conquest of the land of Canaan, although it is that. Understanding how God brought his people, his special purchased possession, into possession of the promised land, this promise that he was going to give them, that he had promised so many years ago to Abraham, but as a spiritual lesson also for us today, as an example for us in our conversion. So let's look briefly at some of the events in the book of Joshua about that story. So if you remember, Joshua had sent out two spies into the city of Jericho to spy out the land as he was across the Jordan, getting ready to pass over the Jordan. And they ended up, these spies did, in the house of Rahab in Jericho, the harlot. And she told them that the whole land had feared them and their hearts had melted because of what they had seen happen with Israel as they were coming to the promised land. They saw what the Israelites had done to the king of Og, or King Og, and to the Amalekites, how he destroyed them. They knew what had happened at the Red Sea, and so they were very concerned about this. And so we all know the story about how Rahab had put the scarlet rope in the window and let the men down and told the people of the city that they had gone their way while she was hiding them. And of course, they made a promise to her that she would not be harmed when they went to take the city of Jericho. So when these men came back and the news of this return to Joshua, he set about to cross the Jordan and he prepared for battle. And so there's a few chapters in there talking about and discussing the preparations that they had to cross the Jordan. A whole chapter devoted to crossing the Jordan River. A whole chapter, I think, devoted to the taking the stones out, the Passover, the foreskins that were cut off the men because nobody had been circumcised in the wilderness. All these new men that had come up because everyone had died off in the wilderness except for Caleb. And except for Joshua. These were the only two men that were allowed to come across the Jordan River that were from Egypt. They were very young. So we have here, as we come down to chapter 6 in the book of Joshua, we see, and you know, I was thinking about this, let me interject here, as Mr. Robinson was talking about, the Revolutionary War, and he was talking about the colonists who said, well, we have to first purge ourselves before we purge the redcoats. And that's really what they did here. They purged themselves by the circumcision, by this, you know, by going over the law and saying, these are the things that are expected of us before we enter this land, before they went to purge the land. So in the chapter 6 of the book of Joshua, we see how the army was to make a column around the city, how they were set up to go around the city, and they were told by God to be led by priests with seven ram's horns and carrying the Ark of the Covenant. So you had priests with seven horns, and then you had the Ark of the Covenant following them, and then you had the rear guard following the Ark of the Covenant, and all the people were to fill in around behind them, and they were to make a procession. Now, some people will say, well, that was just to surround the city, and that's it, just stand there and just stare at the city. But really, I think what it intends, and when you look at some of the wording, is to make the times, how many times do you go around? So for the first 6 days, they were all to go around the city one time. And you all know this story. Every day for the first 6 days, one time around the city, go back to the camp, and the next day all the way to the seventh day. And the seventh day was different. On the last day of unleavened bread, they were to go up to the city. And the same thing was to happen. And by the way, when each day when they were going around, each individual day, the priests were blowing the horns. But the people were to remain silent. Say nothing. Don't say anything. But the seventh day was different. So the priests were in front. They were blowing the horns as they went around. But on the last time, he said that when you go around and the priest will blow the horn, then everyone will shout. And when they shout, they will deliver the city into God will deliver the city into the hands of the Israelites. And so they did. They blew the horns, and everyone shouted in unison with the trumpets, and the walls of Jericho, as the song says, came tumbling down. And there's a lot of debate over how these walls came tumbling down and whether they really came tumbling down or not. I know there's one particular thing out there I was watching on the military channel who said that, no, they didn't really fall down. It was a metaphor, because what really happened was they walked around the city to distract these men who were climbing up the scarlet rope into Rahab's house so they could secretly infiltrate this. So over the course of 6 days, you could have 10 or 15 men who could secretly infiltrate, because no one could see the red rope except for the Israelites. Obviously, the Jericho couldn't see it because they were completely shut up. The inhabitants there didn't know about it. So this is their take on what had happened. This was metaphorical. We see nothing like this in the Bible, that there was any hint or indication that anybody secretly snuck into the city. And even if they did, I don't know how in the world... Well, they said they didn't tear it down, so that wouldn't make sense. But there's no indication of it. But we know from archaeological history that the walls came tumbling down. In fact, they came tumbling down in such a way that it created a ramp up into the city for the Israelites. So they didn't have to necessarily climb over stuff. It was just a ramp, and they ramped right up in there, and they were able to destroy the inhabitants of the city. Now, God said something very specific about the taking of Jericho. He said, when you take Jericho, he said, you leave nothing alive. Nothing is to stay alive. Women, children, animals, everything was to be destroyed. The only thing that could be taken from Jericho was the gold, the silver, the brass, those precious metals could be taken. But even then, it was only for the treasury of the temple. It wasn't for individuals. And God said, these are my instructions. This is what I want you to do. Go in, take the land, you destroy everything in its wake. Now, there's certain conditions, certain exceptions for this, and God specifically tells them certain places, they could take booty, they could take the animals, but they were to destroy the people. Now, why would they destroy the people? This is a contention, I think, for people who don't believe in God, who are atheists. Well, why would a good, all-loving God command that all these people be killed, even children? Because, listen, all of you have watched movies. Has anybody not watched a movie in here? Do you see what happens when you leave the child alive of someone that you've killed? They have a revenge instinct that kicks in, and they will come back their entire lives, and they will figure out how to get back at you for what you did. So when God says to go in and wipe them out, it's for a very specific reason. And the spiritual reason, obviously, I think is there, is that when you come in, and let's say we're going to equate the city of Jericho with sin, and I think that's a good comparison, is that you wipe sin out so that it doesn't have a way to come back at you. You wipe it out and you completely obliterate it with fire. So they were to take only those things. Brethren, I have a question for you. What is your Jericho? What is your Jericho? You know, everyone that comes to God has a Jericho. Everyone that comes to God has a city that stands in their way as they try to take the lands and the things that God has promised to them. Each one of us has a city that looms large over us as we begin to make our walk with God. And it could be that a Jericho is an initial difficulty that you may have had to overcome while you were being called. It was something that you faced only at the time when God was calling you. And when God calls you out of the world, and this is different for me in a sense, and for my kids, and for the Robinsons' kids, and those who grew up in the church, Dan, it's a bit different. But if you are called out of the world, Jericho is something that looms large. And for some people, and I've heard this story repeatedly over the years from various people, is that the pagan holidays were very difficult thing for them. I think with my parents, initially for the first couple of years, the ability to put Christmas behind when it was such an entrenched part of their life was almost a Jericho for them, to be able to conquer that and to be able to make it through that initial roadblock. What is your Jericho? You know, it may not even have to be the initial thing that is an obstacle in your way as you begin your walk with God. It might be a challenge in your way that you maybe had immediately after baptism. Sometimes things come on that way. It could be a challenge that may be the biggest single trial of your life. Maybe that could be your Jericho. What is your Jericho? You know, for me, and I thought about this, and I could probably say several things, but for me, I think that I may take it the approach that it's something which was the initial roadblock on my walk with God. That's the way I look at it myself, is the initial roadblock. So when I was 7 years old, I went out to see my dad in Colorado for the first time after my parents had split up. So my mom had split when I was 6 or 7, somewhere around that time. And he moved to Colorado. We lived in Kansas City originally. He moved to Boulder, Colorado. And it was decided, I don't know how, but it was decided that I would stay the summers with him. And so it was my first summer, I think, I was 7 in 1975, I believe. And one Saturday we went out and we saddled up the horses, got them out of the fields, went to the stables, saddled up the horses, and rode around on Saturday. And I remember thinking this was kind of strange. why are we out here on Saturday riding around? And of course, your memory fades as you get older, and I don't remember these things quite well. Maybe it was the first Saturday, maybe it was the second Saturday. I don't really remember. But apparently on some Saturday, you know, we had been riding around for a few hours, and my dad had stopped going to church at some point after my parents split. And I don't remember when it was. And so I must have asked my dad, I must have asked him why he didn't go to church. I must have asked him that. For years, I think I asked my dad, why weren't we going to church? But thinking about it more in his response, I must have asked him, why aren't you going to church? Because his response back to me was a bark. Don't ask me that again. And so from that point on, never came up. I never asked him that question again. And so every summer, I rode horses on the Sabbath. And I knew that that's something I shouldn't be doing, but I didn't have a whole lot of control over that at that age. And so we raced horses on the Sabbath. We'd go to Gymkhana's and we'd do barrels and keyholes. And frankly, I had a good time doing that. I really enjoyed that. It was hard at first, but it got better. And it was just something I enjoyed doing with him. It was something I enjoyed doing altogether anyway. But every Saturday, I just remember riding horses. We went up camping in the mountains sometimes, but I don't remember a whole lot of other things, so we must have done it a lot, or it made a strong impression on me. I believe it was 1981 before I went to Colorado for the summer that year. I think that's what year it was. My mom had, now I do remember this pretty vividly, we were in the kitchen, and my mom had been talking to me here and there about accountability and responsibility to God's law and doing the things that I knew I should be doing that were right. And she didn't push me. And we were talking about, frankly, about the Sabbath services in Colorado, amongst other things. And she didn't push me and she didn't yell at me about this. Obviously, she knew I didn't have a whole lot of control over this because my dad was going to be able to tell me what I did and where I went and what I was going to do on Saturday for the most part. But as I got older, and I think I was about 13, there was a gentle encouragement from her. Just a real gentle encouragement. And I think if she had pushed too hard, it might have, you know, gone the other way. But I think she did it the right way. You know, eventually we all have to come to decisions on our own, and I think mine was in somewhat way a sort of a unique circumstance. So she handed me the name, I remember, and the number on this piece of paper, the name of a young lady and her telephone number that we knew from Des Moines several years ago when I was little, before we moved from Des Moines to Kansas City. And she said, if you want, you can call her. And she, I've already talked to her. She said she'll take you to church and she'll bring you back home again. And Denver was, I think, about 30 minutes from Boulder. So she'd have to come get me and then go to church and then come back and take me. And so I kept the number. And here I was at the age of 13, I think agonizing over this Jericho moment for me. Jericho was standing in the way. I knew at this time, at this house, they raced horses right down the road. It wasn't that far. I mean, before it was in Westminster in Colorado. So we had to drive. But it was right down the road. And I knew this was going to be a little bit harder because I couldn't get out of this so easily. And I knew my dad wanted me to ride horses. I knew that if I didn't say something too soon, you know, it would be too late because I'd kind of be in it. And you're like in it and you're like, how do I get out of this? You almost feel stuck in some ways. And so this was a stronghold in my mind that had been built, that I loved riding horses with my dad. And I think he loved riding horses with me. That would be my assumption. And I didn't want to disappoint him. But also there was that inner ring, as it were, of that city, of that stronghold, that in my mind, I had thought to myself, if I say anything about church to him, there's going to be a blow up. There's going to be an argument. He's going to yell at me. And I didn't know. So one morning, I remember sitting across the table. I don't remember what morning it was. We were sitting there. And he was sitting across with his paper. You know, as men do. Sit with their paper up, covering their faces. And he's drinking his coffee. And I'm sitting across there looking at that paper, thinking, if I want to say something, I should say it now, because I don't have to look at him in the eye. It's much better if you don't have to look him in the face. Sometimes Max comes up and talks to me from behind here. I'm like, come around, let me see you. So my heart was beating really fast, and I said, finally get up and I said, Dad, can I go to church? Silence. And I said, well, Pam, and he knew, I don't remember her last name, but I said, Pam so-and-so, and I knew he knew she was, said that she could pick me up and she could bring me back. And finally, out from behind that paper, okay, if that's what you want to do. And so I did. And so I went to church that whole summer with Pam. And I think for me, Jericho was conquered. I think for me, that was it. I can think of other things too, but there are many cities to conquer, isn't there? There's other cities to go on to. In fact, he got to the point where he would actually go to Denver and he would pick me up from church. Or sometimes he would actually take me to church. So this later on didn't become a point of contention between us. When you look at 2 Corinthians chapter 10 with me. Second Corinthians chapter 10. You know, though Joshua and the Israelites fought the inhabitants of the land, you see, they fought flesh and blood, didn't they? They fought the people who were there, the physical components of the land. But we don't do that today. There's no land that God tells us to go out and take over. It's not there. We fight something that is even more powerful than what Joshua fought in his day. We have something that is more challenging than Jericho. Look at 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 3. For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God in the pulling down of strongholds. What stronghold exists in your mind, brethren, that has been built up over the course of years that needs to be overthrown? That needs to be torn down? Is there a stronghold there that you sit back and you watch as the workers just build it and it gets taller and bigger and wider and broader because you haven't tackled it? Verse 5, casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God. Now, what exalts itself against the knowledge of God? Well, there could be hundreds of things. One of the things that comes to my mind as I try to wipe this out of my head, which tends to get in there, is negativity. And I tend to be negative at particular points in my life, and negativity is something that I think exalts itself against the knowledge of God. You know, when God said to Joshua to go in and take the land, oh, and while you do it, I want you to be strong and I want you to have courage. I want you to be courageous because I'm never going to leave you. I'm never going to forsake you. I'll always be with you. Joshua didn't return back to him and say, well, have you seen, God, how tall those walls are? Have you actually looked at them? I mean, I had spies that actually went and looked at them. I know how tall those walls are. God, do you know how thick they are? Do you know how thick those walls are? How do you think I'm going to scale up those walls with archers standing atop that building? They're going to kill all of us. How is it even possible? How do you expect me to break through those walls? Well, that's negativity, exalting itself against the knowledge of God. God just told him. God knows. We know what he tells us in the Bible. In fact, he tells us in the New Testament. But be strong and have good courage, because I will never leave you nor forsake you. And yet we say those things back to God. But God, what if? Or God, don't you see? Or God, don't you know? Or God, don't you understand? I know, Lord, that you said you will always be with me and have courage, that no matter what happens? I will always be okay, but I just don't believe you. I just don't believe you. That's negativity exalting itself against the knowledge of God. This, brethren, has to be cast down. This is a stronghold that has to come to its end. It has to be toppled over. It has to be brought into captivity. Look at verse 5 as it continues. And bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. So the question that I first ask you is, what is your Jericho? What is your Jericho? After Joshua and the Israelites defeated Jericho, they moved on. And Joshua sets his sights on the city of Ai now. And I know some people say I and some people say Ai, and I look up the phonetic reference and it says Ai, so I say Ai. And after the spies said the city would be easy to take, Joshua just sent up a couple thousand soldiers. But Israel was routed in the story, and there was 36 Israelites who were killed as they had to return back to their home base. And this greatly grieved Joshua, because Joshua was saying, wait a second, God said he's going to be with us. Whatever we do, we're going to be successful. Why did something like this happen? And God answered to Joshua in Joshua chapter 7, he answered him in verse 11, and he said, Israel has sinned. Israel has sinned. They have transgressed my covenant that I commanded them. They have taken some of the devoted things. They have stolen and lied and put them among their own belongings. You know, I think IE is typical for a lot of us in our Christian battle. We have a great success when we take down a stronghold. And that feels really good. When you have a successful battle and you've overcome something, and you feel really good about it, and I think rightfully so. It's something that you should feel very accomplished, knowing that God was with you as you took over that city, and you were to be able to destroy it. And the next thing you know, what happens is you have a monumental letdown. Sometimes we'd like to sit back and enjoy our success a little while as we took Jericho. Well, let's enjoy that. Why can't I take a silver coin or two for me? What's the big deal? I'll enjoy the fruits of my labor. I earned it. I worked hard. And then the next battle comes along and bam, you're blindsided. Because you're too busy looking at that coin. It wasn't yours in the first place. That goes into the Lord's treasury. That is stored up in heaven for you. It's all put together for you. God shares it all with you. Not right now. Not right now. That goes into the treasury. Don't worry about the coin. He's going to give you plenty of goodness as you go along. He'll give you just what you need, and maybe with blessing a little more. But you need to be prepared for the next battle, because whether you know it or not, it's already sized you up. It already is looking for you. It already knows you. It already has a plan in mind for you. And this is what happened at IE. If you're still in 2 Corinthians, and I should have had you hold your place, I want to show you something that we did not read in verse 6. 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 6. But notice what it says in 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 6. And having a readiness to punish all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled. Okay, so once your obedience has been fulfilled, once you've done everything that you've been told to do, and Jericho has fallen, now you have to be on guard. Now you have to be on guard and be aware and be ready to put down all disobedience, because these things will come at you. Because the enemy is out there and he's looking for the right opportunity. And it tends to happen when we're looking at that pretty coin that we took from the last battle. As Jesus said in Luke chapter 12, when we have brought all the grain into the storehouses, don't say, soul, I've taken everything that I can possibly hold and I've built extra buildings and I think, you know what, I'll just store it in there and I will sit back and take my leisure. And I will enjoy the successes, and I will relax, eat, drink, and be merry. You know, I think of some of the successes that so many teams of this world, and how hard it was for them to do, then said, you know what, I think I'll enjoy the trophies that I've collected over the years. Those trophies of overcoming, and they lost sight that there were so many more cities along the way that they were going to have to face and defeat. With Joshua, once the sin of Achan was discovered and destroyed, only then were they able to attack and defeat the city of Ai. You see, when we trust God in every aspect of our lives, when we put trust that in Him that He will take care of us in the good times and in the bad times, and we submit ourselves to the power of Christ dwelling in us, only then can we expect victory. So Joshua went on to conquer many more cities in Canaan. He took, for instance, Lachish in 2 days, and Lachish then went on to become one of the strongest fortresses in Judah. Now, a lot of the other cities he said to completely demolish. Joshua went on to conquer many more, multiple cities after that. You know, perhaps there's a stronghold out there that you have not yet reached. There's something on the horizon that's coming up. And because of your past victories, your Lachish will be overcome quickly. And it's not going to take long. Because of what you've done in the past, He set you up for it, He's prepared you, and you get to that next city and bam, it just falls. And you didn't expect it, but it's in 2 days it's gone. And that weakness will be turned into strength. The weakness of that city that was yours at the beginning, now it's a fortress, now it's a stronghold for you. How many of you have ever heard of the name Nick Vujicic? Nick Vujicic is a man who was born in 1982 in Melbourne, Australia. And unbeknownst to his parents or doctors at the time, when he was born into this world, he didn't have any arms and he didn't have any legs. No limbs whatsoever. Throughout his childhood, Nick had dealt with only the typical challenges of school and adolescence. Not only, I should say. He dealt with all of those things that we deal with going through school, but you know, things like bullying. And you can imagine the kind of bullying back then. You see it today. I think they've done some things to curb some of that. But back then, to see the bullying that went on for him in school because of his disability without having arms or legs, and you can imagine the esteem issues that go along with that, thinking that he was worthless, and he struggled consequently with depression. And he had a lot of loneliness in his life, and he questioned many times, why was he even alive? Why was he so different from other kids? Why was he born? And he couldn't get the haunting question out of his mind of, why would God let me come into this world without arms and without legs? And so as Nick grew, he learned eventually to deal with his disability, and he gradually accomplished more on his own. But it was a turning point in his life when someone intervened. And that person who intervened in his life was a janitor, of all things. It was a janitor at his school who said, you know what, Nick? He said, you should start speaking publicly about your disability and talk to people about how you've overcome the adversities in your life. And so Nick was up to the challenge, and he took it. And how many people, how many of us would be unwilling at 17 or 18 or 19 to stand in front of a group of people and talk about our lives and how difficult that was? I remember in Spokesman's Club with all of my appendages attached, but he did it without it. And so he started speaking to small groups and students when he was just 17 years old, and then after high school, Nick went on to college, and he had obtained a double bachelor's degree. But it was Nick's passion to encourage other people by giving speeches revolving about his life story, about his difficulties. And so he became his life to do this. This was Nick's Lachish. This was his Lachish. He turned victory into a fortress. Victory over his disability. He turned it into focus. And he has now spoken to over 400 million people worldwide about his story. Our life is a battle. It's a battle. And, you know, sometimes we focus so much on the aspect of peacemaking and compassion and concern and caring and loving and hope, and all those are great things. And we should focus on that. I'm not saying we shouldn't. But these things that are in the particular mold, these parts of Jesus Christ's mold that we focus on, that we sometimes truly forget, brethren, that we are Christian soldiers. We are soldiers going unto war. Look at 2 Timothy chapter 2. 2 Timothy chapter 2. Paul writes to Timothy here in 2 Timothy chapter 2, and let's look at verse 3. He says, share in suffering as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. Now, suffering can come in many forms. Many forms. We can suffer wrongly for things that are out of our control. Can you think of anything that you have suffered for that has been out of your control? I mean, Nick had something out of his control he suffered for. But there are things that you didn't ask for, you didn't set up, nothing. You did nothing. And yet, this is your lot. And you've suffered in that. You know, there are several things I can think of myself. Let me give you just one example. Only it's tangentially related to me, in that I know this person. I went to Ambassador College with someone, and let's call her Jennifer. And Jennifer was a couple of grades behind me, and Jennifer was a very beautiful girl. And, you know, every year when the next class comes in on campus, and I don't think this is specific to Ambassador, this is every campus, every year when the new class comes in, the boys check out the girls that are coming in to find out who's the new girls coming in. And I really feel bad almost for the girls, because the better in one sense of their social life is their freshman year, because they've got, you know, they've got freshmen guys that are after them, sophomore guys, they got junior guys, they got senior guys, right? And then the next year comes along, they turn to be sophomores, and then they it's like crickets, non-existent, because everybody's turned and focused on all the freshman girls that are coming in. And, of course, we had to be reminded of this in forums and assemblies and whatnot, that we can't forget the girls in our own class. But, you know, at college, of course, if you're not studying for a test, boys are talking about girls, and girls are talking about boys. That's the conversation. That's the way it goes. And that's just the way our brains are wired. That's the way they work. But anyway, back to Jennifer. You know, as pretty as she was, you know, she seemed to have the pick of the lot. Just basically whoever wanted to date her. I mean, she would just whoever she wanted. I just remember thinking. And now, I never dated her. I don't remember. I mean, let's call it date, okay? So we would go on dates. We would go on Bible study dates, or we'd go on brunch dates. So I dated, I should say, you know, the dated, put that in quotes, you know, over 100 girls at college. That doesn't mean we dated exclusively or anything like that. Just once you went out and got to know people, and you got to know yourself by interacting with others. That's what that was for. But I never dated her, and I think she actually paired up with somebody fairly quickly at college. But I do remember seeing Jennifer, and this is getting to the point of my story, in the bookstore one time my senior year, and I think it was toward the end of the year as we were winding down things, and as I was talking to her briefly, I remember thinking that she had a bright future ahead of her. She was, like I say, she was very beautiful, she was smart, she was witty, she was articulate, she seemed to have a love for God. You know, there are times when you look at someone and you think to yourself, they're going to have a good life. They're going to have a good life. Things are going to go well for them. And I thought that about Jennifer as I left the bookstore. Well, I wouldn't see Jennifer again for, I don't know, at least 16 years. And when I did, she was happily married. And I think she had two children at the time. Maybe she had three, but I kind of remember two. And one of them was running around and playing, and the other one was in a high-backed wheelchair. And I came to learn that her daughter had spina bifida, and she had a mental disability. And I remember my heart sank for her on, or for many reasons, I think. I think Max was about one when this happened. He was very young. But there was the hard work, I thought, that I knew she would have to be dealing with day in and day out, of dealing with her daughter, and the effort and the sacrifice it took to care for her. And I think at that time, mostly, it was really for the shattered expectations and the dreams that she had for her life and for her husband. I mean, let's face it, when we marry and we start a family, we don't start out with the expectation that our kids are going to have disabilities. That's not your expectation. You don't think that's going to happen. You don't believe that's going to happen. You don't dream of, for instance, wiping drool from your child's mouth for more than a year or two. That's okay, a year or two. But beyond that, that's not what I had in mind. That's not my dream. We don't hope to change diapers for many, many years to come. We don't think about those things. You know, girls, little girls don't write in their diaries. And if Annika has a diary, or even boys, if you have a diary and you're writing what your future aspirations are, what you hope will happen. Even in my high school book that we had where we put things in, it would ask you, what do you expect in 5 years? What do you expect in 10 years? You know, you don't write in there, well, I hope that my daughter, when she turns 10, can spell at least her name. Those aren't things that you write down. You know what I'm saying. Those are not our expectations. And when almost anything diverts from our expectations, there's some trauma and there's some suffering that happens to us. If anything diverts, it happens to our minds, to our psyche. You know, one of the reasons for disagreements in marriages or friendships is because our reality doesn't match our firm expectations. Things just, you know, we have a picture in our mind about how we think things should be. And when we can't take that image and overlay it with reality, and it doesn't match up perfectly, right? Then we've got a problem. Then we've got some sort of suffering that we feel that's going on in us. Let me tell you something very important. Sharing in the suffering of Jesus Christ as a good soldier has little to do with situations like this. Now, I'm not saying that what Jennifer's going through, what you're going through, or what I'm going through is not suffering. It is. It emphatically is. But suffering for the sake of suffering is not fulfilling the role of a Christian soldier. Fulfilling the role is how we handle the suffering. How do we handle the suffering? This is of critical importance. You need to understand with distinction, because everybody suffers, brethren, in some way, shape, or form. That is the lot of this physical plane. We all suffer, but we all respond differently to it. And if I'm down the road here and I accidentally hit somebody in traffic and we both go through suffering and the person gets out of there and shoots at me because of that suffering, they didn't handle it right, did they? They didn't handle it in a godly fashion. That is a city that I see that has to be overcome. That is a city that has to be taken down. That is the battleground of the mind. Is how do you deal with all of these unwarranted circumstances in our lives on a day in and day out basis? What is our response in it? These are the cities that have to be taken. Those cities are a spiritual battlefield. How do we handle? How do we feel? How do we respond? How do we behave? How do we act? You know, it's one thing to see Nick Vujicic without arms and legs and to be up there on the stage and inspire everybody because he's telling everybody how he overcame his difficulty. And that is commendable, and it's a wonderful thing. But what if he was up there telling you how miserable he was all the time? Would I want to hear that? What if he was up there telling you how he wanted to kill himself? Why didn't his parents put him to death? You know, I mean, all sorts of negative reasons. That's the difference between a good soldier, is we all suffer. But how do you deal with the suffering? Let me show you some scriptures. Look down further in 2 Timothy chapter 2 here. Because he's going to tell us some of these things that I want to show you. In verse 14, he says, "Remind them of these things and charge them before God to not quarrel about words." This is a battle in the mind. Don't quarrel about things. This is a city that you have to take, which does no good, but only ruins the hearers. Verse 16, "But avoid irreverent babble, for it will lead people into more and more ungodliness." Verse 17, their talk will spread like gangrene. These are cities you've got to battle. You've got to take down. Verse 23, "Have nothing to do with foolishness, ignorant controversies." And verse 24, "And the Lord's servant must not be quarrelsome, but kind to everyone, able to teach, and patiently enduring evil." Being quarrelsome may be a city that you've got to take down. Now I want you to look over in the next chapter, in 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 1. He says, "But understand this, that in the last days there will come times of difficulty," or perilous times. "For people will be lovers of self, lovers of money, proud, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to parents, ungrateful, unholy, heartless, unappeasable, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not loving good, treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having the appearance of godliness but denying its power. Avoid such people." If it's in our minds, we've got to destroy these things. But look at the characteristics that people will manifest because of the battleground in the mind, and they're losing the battle. And this is what manifests. Now, the things that are listed here are about traits that we'll see in the last days, but we see the manifestation of them in the actions and people's behavior. But again, the mind is where the battle's being waged. It's in the mind. For instance, and let me just pull out a couple, proud and arrogant. These are things that are limited to the world. I mean, you can see this in somebody just by how they carry themselves, their behavior. But there are cities in the plains and the cities in the mountains that we need to conquer in our minds as we battle toward the kingdom. Let me look over at Galatians chapter 5. Look over at Galatians chapter 5 here. I'm going to read from the NET Bible in Galatians 5. Verse 16. "But I say, live by the Spirit, and you will not carry out the desires of the flesh. For the flesh has desires that are opposed to the Spirit, and the Spirit has desires that are opposed to the flesh. For these are in opposition to one another, and you can't do what you want. But if you're led by the Spirit, you're not under the law. Now the works of the flesh are obvious: sexual immorality, impurity, depravity, idolatry, sorcery." Now I want you to notice, sandwiched in here between all these things that we would consider horrible things, next comes hostilities, strife, jealousy, outbursts of anger, selfish rivalries, dissensions, factions, envying. And then we go to something that is much more reprehensible, if we consider that way: murder, drunkenness, carousing, and similar things. "I'm warning you, as I've warned you before, those who practice such things won't inherit the kingdom of God." So these things that are sandwiched in here, these are more of the subtle subjects that are intertwined with others. In other words, you know, it's difficult to have any of these if there isn't anybody else around. Of course, these can be manifest toward God. You can expose, you know, "I'm angry at you, God. I'm jealous at you for what you have," you know. But on an island, you're not going to have rivalries and factions and dissensions. Although there is that joke, I think, about the Church of God, that somebody came on the island to pick him up and he said, "Are you the only one?" He goes, "Yeah." He goes, "What is this building over here? It says Church of God, and you have this one over here, it says Church of God." He goes, "Oh, that's the church I left. I went to the other church." That's the history of our church. Verse 22, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such there is no law. Why is the law not made for the righteous, but for the sinner? Here it is. Because the sinner needs to be told what they're doing wrong. The righteous don't need to be told. In our subdivision, you can have very few laws, but if all of a sudden somebody goes out there and they start, you know, let's say they're going to run around naked, I guarantee you there's going to be a law come up really fast. Don't run naked around our neighborhood. But it wasn't there until somebody did it. The law is for the sinner. This is what you're doing wrong. Stop doing it. Verse 24, now those who belong to Christ have crucified with the flesh with its passions and desires. So this is the battle that we wage at Jericho, at Ai, at Lachish, or at Hebron. These are the battles. Verse 25, if we live by the Spirit, let us also behave in accordance with the Spirit. Let us not become conceited, provoking one another, being jealous of one another. So I could contrast the two previous stories that I told you, the story about Jennifer, the story about Nick, that she suffered in. I didn't tell you. She suffered. We started late. Hold on. She suffered for the situation she was in, but what I didn't tell you is she could never come to terms with it. She could never come to terms with having a child that has spina bifida and that had a mental disability. She couldn't come to terms and have faith in God and belief that He was with her. She couldn't be strong and courageous, and she ultimately decided that there must not be a God. Because how could He allow me to go through such a horrible situation? Why couldn't He change what was going on? Why couldn't He arrest it? Why couldn't He stop it or change its course? Why wasn't her daughter healed? And then we have the case of Nick Wojcich, who was born with no arms and legs, and he considered suicide at one point. But yet he responded to his condition in nothing less than what we would consider godly. And that's the cities that we have to face. One last thought before I close here today. I won't read it to you, but you can read later in Judges, I believe it is, Judges chapter 2, I think. You can read later in Judges chapter 2 about after Joshua had died, because Joshua could not take the entire land of Canaan. He was too old, that had passed. But you can read about how all the different tribes did not drive out the inhabitants of the land. And really, in this flesh, brethren, that's what will happen. As much as we battle, as much as we fight, as much as we push towards the kingdom, as much as we try to take that battle space in the mind, we can't completely take it all in this time, in this day and age. It won't happen. We can't conquer all the cities. We can't reach that physical perfection in this physical flesh. But we can do the best that we can do to conquer everything in front of us in the time that we have. And so as we get older and we all age and we wonder, what do I have to do with my time? There is plenty to do. There's plenty to do with your time. Redeem the time, because there's lots of battles that are going to be facing you today, tomorrow, and into the next year as we battle to take the land, the Holy Land, the land of Canaan. So brethren, as we are Christian soldiers marching as to war, we have many battles to fight in the years ahead. So keep fighting, because, brethren, the promised land is out there waiting for you.